Schönen guten Abend von meiner Seite. Mein Name ist Martin Connection und ich darf heute hier die Buchvorstellung von Paul Saito zu seinem vielbeachteten Buch Systemsturz vorstellen. Wir haben das Buch auch hier in wahrscheinlich nicht ausreichender Zahl, aber dennoch zum Verkauf. Im Anschluss wird es dann verkauft. Ich glaube 35 Exemplare haben wir, das wird vielleicht nicht ganz reichen, aber genau, offensichtlich gibt es an diesen wichtigen Ideen ein großes Interesse und sonst kann man es sicher auch im gut sortierten Buchhandel kaufen. Ich freue mich sehr, dass wir Paul Saito heute hier haben, um das Buch vorzustellen. Die Diskussion selbst werden wir in Englisch abhalten. Ich hoffe, das ist okay für alle. Wenn ihr im Anschluss Fragen habt, dann könnt ihr die aber auch gerne auf Deutsch stellen. Paul versteht soweit Deutsch, das ist gar kein Problem, wenn ihr euch da sicherer fühlt, aber die Diskussion selbst wird auf Englisch stattfinden. Habe ich sonst noch irgendwas vergessen? Ja, genau, vielleicht eine kleine Einladung. Wenn ihr von so guten Bildungsveranstaltungen haben wir selten, aber viele gute Bildungsveranstaltungen haben wir. Und wenn ihr daran davon erfahren wollt, dann könnt ihr euch hier in den Newsletter für die KPÖ Bildungsangebote eintragen. Genau, und dann würde ich schon anfangen mit der Diskussion. Cool, your book was like very popular, or is still very popular, also here in the German-speaking world. Maybe starting from the beginning, can you explain to us what are the main problems of capitalism, ecology and growth? So what is the main problem, the main argument that you make there?
Oh, that's a very good question. But first of all, thank you so much for coming. Bedanke mich herzlich. It's very interesting because the Japanese Communist Party, Deikaiyo, never invites me to this kind of event. They have the newspaper called the Red Flag. They never mention my book, my name, even though they are like profiting from the popularity of my book. The image of Marx and the image of communism is changing in Japan right now because of this book. And then we have this very serious crisis of climate crisis, and we really have to challenge the capitalism. So in Japan, we are also trying to build a new movement, but there is this divide. No? But I'm very happy that the Austrian Communist Party is open to new ideas, and I'm very happy that I'm here to discuss issues with you. So the question, the relationship capitalism, ecology, and so on, my idea is basically that the traditional Marxism was obsessed with productivism. We often think workers do not have enough, so we need more, we have to produce more, and we have to distribute more, and so on and so on. But what happened actually is that the increase of productive forces are destroying the planet right now. So we actually need a different way of thinking about new society. What is clear is that capitalism is characterized by constant expansion and constant accumulation of wealth, but this is also accompanied by the destruction of our planet. So Marx was saying that we always have to have some kind of metabolic interaction with nature. His theory of Stoffwechsel is very fundamental, but the capitalism creates a rift, metabolic rift, in this relationship between humans and nature. And I think that the problem of the new capitalism, investing in the renewable energies and electric vehicles and so on, do not necessarily solve this problem. Because as long as we try to consume more, you know, it creates jobs. The green capitalism may create jobs for workers, and it will provide us many good things, new cars, new houses, but these things also consume a lot of energy and resources. And when we really want to have a more sustainable planet, the decarbonization must occur as quickly as possible. But this expansion of the economy, characterized by GDP, is basically doing something against for achieving this goal. So what we have to do is rethink what we want to have. So I will try to reconsider or redefine the concept of abundance. We try to rethink the concept of justice. We try to think the concept of equality, because otherwise maybe some parts of the world, like people like us in the global north, may have good cars now electrified, and we have good houses, but there will be more exploitation of resources and energies and labor power in the global south. So in the end, there will be more inequality and injustice. So we really have to redefine, and then in order to achieve this, looking back the history of imperialism, colonialism, and exploitation, we have to fundamentally rethink the relationship with nature, relationship with the global south, and the relationship with other people in the global north. So in this sense, I think this idea of communism, helping each other, mutual aid, fighting for justice, and then these kind of things must be revived. But in the collapse of Soviet Union in the last 30 years, we haven't tried enough. But I think now it's very clear that capitalism is very creating this problem that we are trying to problematize. And I think the idea of communism needs to be back on the agenda. And the climate crisis is very serious. So my proposal is basically we shouldn't be afraid of, especially like countries like Japan, people so conservative and they're afraid hearing the term like communism. But in my book, I propose degrowth communism. It's not just simply a communism that everyone can have private jets. Some people misunderstand socialism is private jets for everyone, but I don't think so. We can have different ways of abundance, different ways of satisfying our needs. And this is a new way of thinking about communism, which I now call it degrowth communism.
Thank you so much. Maybe before we're talking a little bit more about communism, let's talk about what you called green capitalism. So I would be interested, you said, okay, it leads to more injustice, to more inequality, but would that be able to solve the ecological crisis, or is that not possible with green capitalism?
Well, I think looking back at the history, the countries like Japan and the EU countries are doing better and better, and we have more comfortable life, but at the cost of others. People like Ulrich Blunt in Austria are talking about the imperial Lebensweise, right? So the affluent life in the global north is realized at the cost of people and environment somewhere else. So this is basically the logic of externalization. And Marx said the logic of capital is about constant accumulation of wealth, and especially the value, but this is not always compatible with the material conditions of production, because nature is something independent and they don't necessarily follow the logic of capital. But the problem is, capital tries to accelerate, so the time of capital and time of nature becomes totally separated. They try to exploit the wealth that has been accumulated for many, many years, like fossil fuel. The formation of fossil fuel takes many years, but the capital basically consumes them in a few hundred years. And then this is now creating the climate crisis. But we are not necessarily facing the worst results of this catastrophe. Of course, we have heat waves, we have wildfires, and we have many different type problems, like in Japan, typhoon and so on. But the scale is still okay. We can endure because we have technologies, we have capital to fight against them. Where do these problems come most severely? Countries like Bangladesh and Africa and so on. And these places are lacking in the technologies and capital, but they are also the ones who are least responsible for the crisis. We are the ones who are more responsible for the crisis, but we also have accumulated those technology and wealth to fight against it. So this is the logic of externalization. And what's happening with green capitalism is basically continuing the same thing. Maybe we do something better, no? We emit a little less carbon dioxide with electric vehicles, we might have more sustainable life. But the problem is, as long as we continue buying new cars every 5 years, maybe you guys have longer life cycle of the cars. In Japan, it's usually like 5 years. And we keep buying new iPhones and so on. The consumption of energy and resources will actually continue to increase. And where do resources and energy come from? And it's usually, of course, from global south, Latin America, China, Congo, and so on and so on. So this logic of externalization will continue in the future. So in that sense, the green capitalism is a myth, because it is an ideology, because it seems that we don't really have to change anything about our life. This is exactly why the Green New Deal looks attractive. Right? Many people say, okay, Green New Deal, even among the left, is something that we have to fight after. I have to agree, but I have to disagree, because Green New Deal can be an excuse not to change our life. Green New Deal create more jobs. Green New Deal will reduce the carbon dioxide emission. All things sounds very good. It sounds very attractive. So it can be a very political, attractive political idea. But is that crisis that we are facing right now so easy to solve? I don't think so. It is crisis, it's climate crisis, or even climate breakdown, because it's so serious. Then it means that we also have to radically change what we do as business as usual. So in that sense, maybe we need to think about not only about investing more in renewable energies and electric vehicles, but at the same time, we might have to also reduce the amount of the cars we produce. No? But this is not something the Green New Deal promises. No? They don't want to say. Or we also might have to fly less. No, I actually flew from Japan, sorry. But I came from Zagreb. I woke up at 5 a.m. in the morning and I took the train 8 hours. And then, it's okay. No? There's no problem. But we might fly less. And we also might have to eat less beef, less meat, industrial meat. And we also might have to, you know, reduce advertisement. We also might have to, I don't know, ban fast fashion, fast food, and those things. I don't hear these suggestions from the proponents of Green New Deal, because this is not good for capitalism. This is something that we don't want to hear. But I think we have to face these realities. Right? It doesn't mean, however, once we accept this to some extent, reducing fast fashion is not necessarily unhappiness, right? It can actually bring a better life, because we always have to buy new clothes, and we see all other people doing, buying Zara and H&M and so on. It's just stressful. You know, we can buy one thing that we like and we can use it for a long time. And that kind of society can bring another form of happiness and well-being. We need to distinguish pleasure and happiness. Pleasure is something immediate, like drinking beer. And this is the pleasure. But it doesn't bring a long-lasting effect. And I think that happiness is something that we don't necessarily have to constantly consume and produce and so on. So these are the things that we need to rethink, and then this is something that Green New Deal doesn't promise. And I want to say degrowth sounds a little bit intimidating at the beginning, but if we think a little bit more carefully about our own life and the inequality between global south and north and so on, I think Green New like a degrowth can be very, very attractive idea even for communists.
thank you so much. Before we talk a little bit more about degrowth and communism or degrowth communism, one of the central concepts you're applying in your book is the idea of the metabolic rift. You already mentioned it briefly. Could you maybe explain a little bit what is it, the metabolic rift, the concept proved by Marx, and what is all the strategies capital applies to overcome it?
Okay, so metabolic rift is a very simple concept. Now we have to interact with nature. We are humans, are part of nature. So this is the process of metabolism. We work upon nature, we extract resources and energies from nature, and we produce something, and we create, we consume, and we create waste, and we give them back to the nature. So this is a kind of circular process. But the problem is, in capitalism, this process accelerates. Right? And because capitalism is not necessarily producing things what we need. We have to realize that what capitalism is producing is something unnecessary. They produce anything that is profitable. And they don't produce what is rather necessary because it's not, when it's, it is not profitable, right? So when the things like fast fashion, fast food, and those things accumulate wealth, the process of nature is disrupted because nature exists, of course, independently and prior to capital. So the time of nature, the cycle of nature, the logic of nature is quite different from the time of capital, the logic of capital, and the formation of capital. So these two logics of nature and capital are fully incompatible. What we are witnessing, for example, in the climate crisis, is basically, you know, the fossil fuel is massively consumed, and this is incompatible with the our system and so on. When Marx was writing his Capital, the main issue was agriculture. So the soil is exhausted because capitalist agriculture produces wheat and corn just for the sake of profit, and they don't take care of the soil nutrition anymore. Or he was also writing about deforestation. So people like Eustace von Liebe and Karl Flowers are very important for him. But these things basically continue today. We want to produce more electric vehicles. We extract more lithium, cobalt, nickel, copper, and so on and so on. But these are the things that have been, you know, formed for many, many years. It takes many years. But then capitalism basically extracts them in a very short manner. So the concept of metabolic rift is not complicated at all. Eh? So the logic of capital and the logic of nature are diverse. And this is not something that capitalism cannot repair. Marx says it's irreparable rift. With technologies, you know, with those things, the capital tried to solve it, but it cannot. And I think at some point, we have to simply follow the logic of nature. And we have to recognize that we cannot simply manipulate the nature according to our needs. We also have to follow and respect the independence of nature. And we need to organize our social production within that planetary limit. So these are the things that we have to be aware of. But the problem of capitalism is that it can never recognize limits. Because the capitalism is the system that seeks after infinite valorization, infinite accumulation. So the necessity of recognizing limit that we are currently speaking in terms of the ecological crisis is not compatible with this logic of capitalism. That is simply why Marx said metabolic rift is irreparable. We can never heal it. And then we need to have more conscious social control of production in another way.
Thank you. Maybe to add a little bit on that question, you mentioned this idea that like you can overcome it with more technology, and this is also some strand within Marxism that you criticize, the idea that like the progress of the productive forces will not only liberate humankind, but will also heal this metabolic rift. So what is your criticism of this idea that technology can save us and nature?
I'm not sure how important Marx in Austria among the Communist Party. Is Marx important?
Yes.
Very much?
It's important.
Do you care what Marx says? Okay. So the reason why the Japanese Communist Party, the KPJ, ignores me is basically the following reason. I deny historical materialism in a traditional sense. Huh? Because historical materialism is usually in the following. The mode of capitalist production, the capitalist mode of production has two aspects. Relations of production and the forces of production. And when forces of production increases, there will be a contradiction, a tension with relations of production. And then at some point, it explodes. And then the capitalist mode of production will be overcome. And then here comes the socialist mode of production, the communist mode of production. But according to this understanding of historical materialism, we will think, okay, in order to have socialism, we have to increase productive forces. This is very productivist, huh? More technology, more production, and that's also good for working class. Okay, but it doesn't talk about ecological crisis. It also ignores the fact that the increase of technologies, increase of productive forces under capitalism actually increases the domination over workers. It actually controls more and more what we do. And it actually deprives workers of freedom and independence. So this is what actually Marx talks about in his Capital. For example, he introduces a concept of productive forces of capital. We usually think, okay, we have new technologies, AI and so on, maybe we can use full automation to emancipate us from labor. Huh? That's the kind of the post-capitalist vision called left accelerationist. But the problem is, if we have more automation, more AI, it's quite likely that more and more workers are losing jobs, and they become more desperate to get any jobs that are available, low paid, worse conditions, and so on. So we cannot so naively think that these new technologies will be good for socialists. Because technology is not neutral. Huh? Technology in capitalism only contributes to productive forces of capital, not productive forces of workers. So that means no matter how much we increase technologies and productive forces under capitalism, it will never bring us to socialism. This is actually what Marx realized when he was writing Capital. So in that sense, it also shows that today we have new technologies in order to exploit from nature more efficiently and more massively. So we have more technology, but we workers lose freedom, nature is more exploited, and so on and so on. That means that Western society, Western capitalism, is not necessarily on the higher stage of history. Because we have higher productivity, like including Japan, but that doesn't mean we are closer to socialism anymore. Because this technology that we have right now is simply for the sake of exploiting from humans and nature. Then Marx had to really rethink his idea of historical materialism. That is why in his later years, one of the main topics that I discuss in my book, he started to study not only natural sciences, because he was interested in ecological issues, but also he studied non-Western pre-capitalist societies like Russia, India, and Latin America, and so on and so on. And he realizes that these societies are protecting people's equality, and also it's more sustainable because they don't produce for the sake of profit, right? They try to even restrict the development of productive forces because such a development could concentrate more wealth to some people. So in order to protect the equality and sustainability, they actually limited their own development. Marx used to think that Indian society is not very active, it's very stable, or poor Indians, you know, please come in British colonialism and they will liberate Indian people. But in the 70s and 80s, he really changed his idea. He thinks that, actually Indian people or Russian people have more conscious regulation of metabolic interaction with nature. And this is how he started to question the productive forces, and he abandoned historical materialism, and in the end, he became sort of accepting the steady state of those pre-capitalist societies. And he even said in his letter to Beata Sulich, Western societies have to go back or return to the higher form of Western pre-capitalist societies in order to solve the crisis of capitalism. And this is how I interpret is basically accepting the idea of steady state economy, and this is how he became a degrowth communist. No, read my book, it's a very interesting thing.
Thank you so much. So now we arrive at the topic of degrowth communism, and now I would invite you to tell us a little bit what is your idea of what do you mean by degrowth communism? You said steady state economy, but how can we envision such a society that we call degrowth communism? And maybe do you have a few hints how we might get there?
Yes. The degrowth. Well, when I say degrowth, people, I don't know how it sounds like in Austria, but in Japan. Oh, you want to go back to Edo period? It's like, you know, going back to, you know, pre-capitalist, pre-modern age. No, that's not the case. No? When I say degrowth, one thing is clear. It's abandoning GDP as a measure of our progress and of, you know, prosperity. GDP doesn't count environmental impact. GDP doesn't care equality. And GDP increases with war and those things. No? So we cannot count on GDP after a certain point, but still, today's politics, today's newspaper, it's full of GDP. So degrowth is abandoning GDP. And then degrowth also requires to limit or abandon certain things that are not necessary. As I said, do we really need fast fashion? We need fashion, right? I'm not saying that everyone should say the same thing, but we don't need this excessive production and consumption of goods. So degrowth also requires to slowing down or scaling down some of the things that are not necessary. So in order to facilitate that, or like for example, private jets, we don't need private jets. We should demand more because we never fly with private jets, so it doesn't actually matter. No? So that's one thing. And we also can demand reducing advertisements and so on and so on. So this is one thing, degrowth. And I say degrowth communism, however. No? It's not simply degrowth. It's degrowth. It needs to be degrowth communism. One reason is that when the economy is no longer growing forever, we have to share more. And we also have to produce for the sake of satisfying our basic needs. It means that we spend more for education, medical care, universal medical care, public transportation, electricity, free internet for everyone, that kind of thing. These demands are already there, but we should demand these things. And then we don't necessarily have to grow and grow and grow. We can have more secured life for everyone. And this is very important idea that communist politics have demanded. So the problem is, traditionally, socialism, working class movement have been characterized by some kind of productivism, increase of productive forces, increase of technology, and so on. We socialists need to learn from the degrowth side, because that kind of increase, more consumption and so on, cannot be ecologically sustainable anymore. So we need to find other ways of satisfying our needs and increasing our well-being. This is what degrowth people are advocating for. So I think we socialists need to learn from degrowth people, especially because, so if Marx, what Marx says matters, especially because Marx was also degrowth in the end. And but at the same time, degrowth people need to learn from socialists, communists, because they don't necessarily challenge capitalism. We have to make it clear when degrowth people want to bring some change, they have to realize degrowth and capitalism. Degrowth capitalism is contradictory because capitalism is a system of constant expansion. So we have to have degrowth post-capitalism. And my argument is basically if economy is not growing, and as I said, we have to share more, and sharing basic provisions, education, public transport, and so on and so on. This is the basic idea of socialism, and I believe degrowth communism can be a very attractive idea for many people, and even for working class. Because working class politics is always characterized by raising wages, working more, and so on and so on. But it ignored environment, it ignored the gender inequality, and it ignored other things, right? Exploitation from the global south and so on. Only by learning from degrowth people, for example, we can reduce our consumption, we can also reduce working hours, and then maybe we can spend more time for other things, including like childcare and doing sports. And these are the things that the workers can also accept, and they find it much more fulfilling. So I believe that there's some more interaction with socialism and degrowth, and this is, yeah, my book is about first step of bringing the dialogue with those ideas, especially because in Europe, the idea of degrowth is gaining some influence. So I think the socialists should use this intervention. We should utilize this new idea, and we bring new generations, especially they are concerned about climate change, so we should bring new politics, new ideas, and so on and so on. And I hope that this book will be some kind of contribution for that.
Thank you so much. And this sounds all very convincing, but how do we get there? What are the strategies that we should apply as the left to get towards degrowth communism?
So I think one of the first easiest thing is ban the private jet. Because it doesn't matter to us. The rich people are quite responsible for that kind of extensive consumption. So we should ban private jets, but we should also ban, I don't know, I mean, we can ban so many things. Like cruise ships and private yacht. And,
but who should ban them? Who should do that?
But we should first demand that kind of thing. I think we can, you know, there are ways, you know, we can demand companies not to produce those things. Like, for example, Ferrari should not produce those sports cars anymore. They should produce something better for the environment and for the people. So companies could do, but when the companies don't do, we should demand the state, the government, to intervene. So in that sense, I'm a very traditional socialist. I count on the state power as well. But the problem is, before discussing how we can actually achieve those concrete policies, I think we shouldn't be afraid of demanding that kind of ideas. Especially like conservative societies in Japan, people are afraid of talking about that kind of things. They are afraid that if you say so, other people will say, oh, you're crazy, you're stupid. But I think that limits our political imaginary. So one thing about degrowth communism is expanding our political imaginary. We shouldn't be afraid of talking about that kind of ideas. We shouldn't be afraid of talking about communism. We shouldn't be afraid of banning private jets and cruise ships. in order to achieve that goal. But there are other ways. I was massively criticized when I talked about maximum income. But I said on the TV, we can start with 1 million yen, or not the 1 million US dollar per year for the maximum income. So we never reached that point. So I thought it was fine. But then people were like, oh, rich people will be leaving Japan and so on and so on. But I don't understand. It doesn't matter to you. But people are afraid. So that's how we are just, thinking that we are forced to believe that the capitalism should be about free competition and making more money and so on and so on. But so banning them, maximum income, and also reducing work hours is also good because this is compatible with some kind of working class movement. And then maybe like free education, I mean this is already realized in Europe, but the free high education is not possible at the moment in Japan, so free education, free public transportation, and these kind of things can be the foundation for the further step. I'm kind of like a reformist, but it's not like, it's more like a revolutionary reformist. I call it Rosa Luxemburg's revolutionary realpolitik. So this is kind of the transitions that we can make today, but gradual. After the increase, after even we ban private jets, it's still capitalism. But the society after banning private jet will look something very different, I believe. And then if we introduce maximum income and then maybe minimum income at the same time, the capitalism will be totally different. Because today's capitalism is about infinite wealth. You could work harder so that you can accumulate infinite wealth. But once this limit is introduced, there is market, there is commodity, there is competition, but this will be totally different. So we should be more creative, and we should be demanding that kind of things. And I think these are the measures that we can like openly talk more.
Thank you. So while you now appeal to the state in your book, what you're criticizing is the like what you call politicism of much parts of the left that hope by electoral politics just changing from above by law. So I think we would share that in the Austrian Communist Party, this criticism. But I was wondering, so what role do you see for political parties on the left, for Marxist parties, in bringing forward such a proposal?
Okay. So I was really happy to get this actually invitation because I knew about Graz. The mayor of Graz is a communist. Sounds very exciting. And in my book, I didn't talk about Graz. Appeal. I only talk about Barcelona and Paris, and these are the places where more progressive candidates, not from the bar, more from the grassroots kind of the candidate came up from the movements, and then they became the mayors and so on. And these are the things that I think it's very impressive. And I know about Graz, and this is all great. I think after the failure of the Soviet Union, we cannot simply count on the state power. Of course, the state power matters. Now, in order to really ban certain industries and we make the great transition for the sake of decarbonizing the entire economy, the state power is necessary. That's one thing I criticize about degrowth people. Degrowth people are a little bit about grassroots and they reject the state power. But I think the socialist tradition can contribute. Because we cannot imagine a society without the state, at least at the moment. We will aim after something like that in 100 years, but now we need some state intervention. So I think the socialism, communism, can help degrowth people to talk about that kind of issues. But at the same time, we cannot simply count on the state power alone, because this becomes very top-down and bureaucratic, and these are the problems that we always had in the 20th century. So in the kind of a compromise will be the starting from the local politics, local government. And I really like the Graz, the Barcelona, and these kind of things. And then we have also started something in Japan, in Tokyo. There's a new mayor in a small city called Suginami and Satoko. Oh yeah. Transnational Institute, and these are the things that it's actually happening. I think that my book contributed a little bit for that election, and so these are the things we will. I'm not rejecting. I criticize actually the politicism in my book, but I'm not saying that we should be neglecting that kind of the engagement with politics and the election. Election politics obviously important, but it is only when or only if we have grassroots movement. And I think the direct participation, like a more kind of the idea of municipalism, is very inspiring. And it's been in Japan spreading, and we learn a lot from European attempts. And so I'm very happy to say thank you for you guys, and then we will have more dialogue and communication.